Welcome to Ahead of the Game, a podcast brought to you by the Digital Marketing Institute. I'm your host, Will Francis, and today I'll be talking to Catherine Mooney all about emotional well-being at work, better managing your balance between work and life, keeping well, effective emotional expression, and hopefully lots more. Catherine works in the psychological health team at a multinational social media platform. She worked for many years with disadvantaged communities on suicide prevention, especially helping men in inner city Dublin with mental health issues. So there's lots for us to talk about. Catherine, welcome to the podcast. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me, Will. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. You, I think you're in a, I don't know if it feels that way, but you're in a very kind of hot topic. You know, you're working within in a very hot topic at the moment, because certainly since the pandemic, mental health, mental well-being at work was already, I think, something that was starting to get recognised as important, but now that's been amplified or intensified, I think. Is that how it feels? Does it feel, you know, more important than ever to you now?
Yeah, I suppose I feel like when you put it like that, I think I might follow disaster for some weird reason, that when I was working in the community sector, I was always working with the most needy, the most stressed, and found myself going into mental health. And I think mental health needs have been catapulted alongside the working styles of lots of people globally into a new hybrid state of working. And with that hybrid state, we have lost a lot of our good habits that would prohibit mental health issues, you know, and kept focus on the workload. So I think it's a conversation that's being had a lot more now, more than ever. Culturally, there's a little bit more freedom for us to talk about it now. It's a little bit more accepted. So I think it's always been there. There's always been a need, but there's been this taboo around the freedom to say, I'm actually not feeling great today, you know, the worry and the concern about, what does this mean? Am I other? Am I crazy? I'm not the same. Will I be, you know, taken out? Will I not belong to my community anymore if I have mental health issues? So I think with this new wave, I suppose, of acceptance, understanding, learning and growth in mental health, it does shine a light on the need for it more so. But I think the need has always been there, but now it's nearly like we're okay to look at it and people are normalising it maybe a little bit more.
Yeah, it's like so many of these issues, you know, I think some people kind of think mistakenly that a lot of these issues are new. They're not, they just haven't been talked about. And you could say that about so many cultural shifts, right, around all kinds of things in history weren't talked about as much. And on the more positive side for a moment, though, do you think that hybrid working has helped some people cultivate better self-care and better kind of mental well-being habits? Have you seen much of that?
Yeah, definitely. Like even myself, like I'm in a position now that I can be remote 2 days a week and in the office three days a week. Oh, there's so much goodness in that. From the little things of getting all my washing done, which is nuts, to being around for my daughter when she comes home from school, and you know, we can kind of have dinner together. So it's really a lot to do with your values as a person. And if your values then and your needs are being met with a hybrid model and you're consciously working, living through your values, that's definitely going to increase your well-being, your mental health, your positive outlook. But it's when you're in a situation where it's going against your values and you're just working because of a need that you have to fill, but you're not really aware of what you're doing and your behaviours, your habits are negative around hybrid working, that's when it can impact your well-being negatively. But I definitely would see positives in it, but it's about being aware of them positives, embracing them positives, enjoying them and getting the best of both worlds. That when you're in the office, you're present, you're with your people, you're with your colleagues, you know, you're there for your meetings. And when you're remote, you've no guilt.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's I think you've said that it's not a work-life balance, it's work-life integration. What do you mean by that?
Good call out. So I suppose before we always kind of had like, right, work-life balance. Do you know, you work your 40 hours a week and you have like your downtime and your activities in the evening, your family time, your weekends off. Now that a lot of companies are gone global, like one big learning for me was when I went into the corporate world is that I got a rude awakening of time zones and that things never stop. So when you're working global, you really have to consider not your work-life balance, but how you integrate your work and your life together. So that may mean, say you're in England and you're working with the West Coast of America and, you know, your meetings are going to be more in the evenings. What are you doing in the mornings? How are you minding yourself? What other things are being taken care of? Whether that's your family needs, your house needs, your social needs, that kind of stuff. So it's about looking at how you work and integrating your needs together rather than saying, actually, right, there's a definite cutoff. Because a lot of us, our phones are connected to us like an extension of our body now, and it's just constantly information coming in. We're constantly available to this work. And it's a good thing about setting boundaries. Having really good boundaries is a really good well-being tool to have. But we need to be realistic in a world now that we are constantly accessed. We are constantly, you know, looked for, seeked for, and our thoughts are kind of constantly with certain work practices.
Yeah, absolutely. Talk to me about that, about, you know, with phones and devices, right? So, yeah, you're right. I think I've gotten quite good at it, switched notifications off and things like that. But I see other people are just, their phones are constantly buzzing. What advice do you give people to better manage their digital devices? Do you have a list of go-to tips that you're always kind of reeling off to people?
I think one thing to mention, though, with hybrid working, we can have digital overload and we can get sucked into that and it can just happen to us. Or like what you've done, you've become aware of, actually, I've been like heavily involved in digital activity, whether it's my phone, whether you're on social media, whatever. And you're making conscious decisions of how you want to spend your time, what information is getting into you. So I would say one tip that I'm constantly barking on about is for you to be aware of the amount of time you are being exposed to anything digital, whether that's social media, whether that's like the telly, whether that's work, whatever it is. And see how you are in that moment. Are you giving energy or are you getting energy? So sometimes, you know, if you're scrolling on social media, you don't know what's coming up next and you don't know how that's going to affect you. So you could be really engrossed in something and then see something shocking and then you're being activated. You have that cortisol rush and you're not sleeping that night. You have your blue lights on in the room. You're not getting a good sleep then either. So the go-to is around self-care with digital information is really have your boundaries. We're all different. Have your limits of what you want and what you don't want. And I think one of the factors or negative implications of watching so many things digital is it can have a knock-on effect to your sleep. And your sleep is so important. So one of the key things I would say to people is try and remove the phone from the bedroom. I know that's so hard to do, but even if you can do it, like, if you can't do it an hour before, maybe a half an hour before, where you start to get into that rest mode and you get a proper sleep. So it's just really limit what you're watching, be conscious of what you're watching and make purposeful decisions of how you engage and when you engage. And a lot of people as well, it's the first thing in the morning. It's like you're not even awake. Your foot is not even on the floor. You're still in bed and they go check the phone and their projection or their day is going to be all set on how we start our day. So whatever we see on that social media or things to do is we're getting activated, we're starting to go and we're getting that rush again. So it's just to be mindful of what it's doing to you.
Yeah, that's right. It's being more deliberate, I think, about using digital devices, isn't it? And using them as a tool rather than just picking them up without really kind of thinking in a kind of measured way, why am I doing this? You know what I mean? So it becomes a reflex, doesn't it? Like you say, the first thing in the morning, a lot of people pick up their phone and look at it without really knowing why. And you're right, there's another thing there. Beginning the day, the way you start the day sort of sets the tone for the day, doesn't it? And starting the day in a more deliberate way that is focused on your kind of self-care and mental well-being would be good. And then the other thing you touched on, yeah, I think I hear that a lot about, you know, don't look at screens and taking that blue light for an hour before bed. I think that is a really hard one to do. I mean, even I'm quite strict about that. But I listen to podcasts as I go to sleep. I just don't look at the screen. You know, I just start the podcast, put it down, and that's it.
Have it on a timer so it turns off then. Do you know that? That's.
I do, yeah. I have a sleep timer on that, yeah. But, okay, so it is just taking control and use having sort of ruling the tech and don't let the tech rule us. I think that's the overall thing there, isn't it?
That's it, yeah. And I think to be aware of our automatic habits that we have. So we have an automatic pilot that runs most of the day that gets us kind of through the day, that feeds us, that kind of gets us into action mode of things that we do. But a lot of our habits are energy zapping, are taking energy from us. And like if you were to count consciously how many times you lift up your phone, a lot of the time you're not purposefully lifting up that phone. It's just a habit. So it's just being aware of your habits and trying to change them habits can be very beneficial to us. And then one other thing as well, it's like making a conscious decision in the morning to potentially practice gratitude. So when you're waking up in the morning, you're not going with your thoughts that come. You're taking control of those thoughts. You're saying to yourself, actually, you know what? I want to start my day with like being grateful for this lovely bed that I have, this job that I have, that lovely shower I'm going to have, that lovely cup of coffee. It's starting to have that mindset of gratitude, but you're taking control of your thoughts again, rather than letting them habitual thoughts come in of what I have to do, have to do this, you know, go there, should have done this.
I'll come back to some of that. I suppose, the most obvious intrusion into our mental well-being in modern job roles is these devices. So just to park that for a minute, there's some less obvious things that can kind of really impact your mental well-being in the modern workplace. And because you deal with this, like this is your job, what are the recurring themes that come up? Because I think I sense they might be a bit less obvious to me.
I'm amazed that how previously I suppose working in the community, what issues that were there, and now that I'm working globally, what issues that are coming up, that the similarities of how we speak to ourselves, how hard we are on ourselves, how much pressure we put on ourselves. It just seems to be an underlying theme across the board that we are so hard and we push ourselves and we expect so much more of ourselves and we speak so badly to ourselves that we would never speak to anybody else like that. That it's sometimes it's changing that inner monologue of bringing in self-compassion. That can be so helpful, or that can hinder us and add to our struggles greatly. So that's one thing I've noticed.
But how do you do that? Because I suppose we're so wired to be self-critical. And you're right, you're absolutely right. We treat ourselves in ways we wouldn't do with other people. But I've heard this sort of technique where you sort of think, well, what would I say to someone else? And you try and objectify yourself a bit and then try and follow that a bit more rather than being so harsh on yourself. But how can I practically get better at that?
Really good question. So I suppose when I started practicing mindfulness, there was a lot of self-compassion that was brought into the mindfulness. It was sitting and becoming aware. Becoming aware is the first step.
Okay.
Of how you're actually talking to yourself.
So just listening to that in a monologue a bit and kind of assessing it.
Just like, look, like even when I'm coming on here today, I'm like, oh my God, this is going to go wrong. I'm going to say something terrible. I'm going to curse. This is just like all the stress going. And I'm like, actually, Catherine, calm down. You know your stuff. You know what you're talking about. So it's kind of like talk to yourself with kindness more than you listen to yourself with harshness. And that starts with becoming aware of how you are in a moment. It's not to think about the week, the month, the year. It's just catching yourself in a moment and remembering to be aware. And then making a choice. And like with a lot of mindfulness, you could think about it like there's a stimulus and there's a response. And with everything, there's something that happens outside, or if we get a thought, and we have this automatic habit of how we're going to respond. But instead, or how we react, instead of reacting, we can choose to take a breath. and decide how we're going to respond. Decide how you're going to respond to your inner monologue. Decide how you're going to react to a pressure of, like, you hear a ping and you're like, oh God, I better answer that email, or I have to do this, or, you know, there's, you see your diary and it's back to back and you're like, you should be better, Catherine. It's making a conscious decision of how you want to treat yourself, because the more we treat ourselves with kindness, the more we flourish, the more we grow, the more energy we have. When we're layering ourselves with these stresses and extra shame and guilt and stress, we're taking too much on. And that's where we kind of lead to burnout, and we have this apathy, we have this languishing. There's just, it's just too much heaviness. It's making decisions to just be that little bit kinder. And it starts in every moment by just remembering to be aware of how am I, and bringing a bit of kindness to yourself.
It's interesting when you talk about this stuff, you reference yourself a little bit. It sounds like you've kind of gone on, you've applied a lot of these things yourself.
Oh yeah, you have to walk to walk. I think they'd catch me out in here, or they definitely catch out in the community. The lads that I used to work with, it was all kind of suicide prevention, and you wouldn't get away with anything. These were burly lads that were unemployed through the recession 2008, and they were taking no messing. And unless I was in there doing the same work as them, with them, and doing the same actions, you know, they wouldn't stay with you. And I think people are right. If you don't have somebody in front of you that's actually doing, putting the work in, putting the hours in, doing, having difficult conversations, making difficult choices, you're not going to listen to them, do you know? But I love this stuff. I love all the self-care stuff. I'm like, yeah, massage any day, mindfulness any day, a bit of yoga. Oh yeah.
That's good. It's good, isn't it? But what you're talking about is all internal work, which absolutely we all need to do. But when you talk to people, you know, in your what you're currently doing, which is helping people in the modern workplace, you know, there's only so far we can improve ourselves internally. And do you sort of find yourself wanting to say to people, do you know what? You need to get out of this job, mate. You know, your boss is not nice. You need to get out of your job. Is that sometimes the brick wall you come up against?
What I do in that situation, which has come across in all of my jobs, 100%, comes in anywhere, everywhere, every culture, every country. I ask the person to talk about their values, talk about what's important to them. Because if we're in a job that's not aligned with our values, that's not aligned with our non-negotiables, we are not going to be happy there. We're not going to thrive. We're not going to be the best version of ourselves. So if they choose, after having an understanding of their values and their purpose and what they want to do with their life, to move on, you know, all power to them. Let's get that person. I'm interested in the person's need, the person's well-being. You know, and I want to help them thrive no matter what they decide to do.
Yeah, you would say that to someone. You know, you would say, look, we're doing a lot of great work here, but you're in a toxic workplace and I can't help you with that.
Best thing I could do is get them to say that. Do you know, I would kind of ask the questions, explore.
Oh yeah, because you get them to articulate their values and say, right, and so where you work, does that align with that? And you get them to go, no.
Yeah, but there's a lot of mirror work going on. There's a lot of, like, I would repeat back, okay, so this is what I'm hearing, this is what you're saying, how do you, what do you think now? Because often, even when you're in therapy, what the therapist is doing is they're feeding back to you the information that they're seeing. Because when you hear it from somebody else, one, you're being purposefully listened to, two, you're being validated, and three, when you hear it back, it's like, you nearly know the decision as soon as it comes out of your mouth of, like, okay, this is not a good situation, I need to move on. And maybe for some reason they have an attachment to not being in a good environment. So then that's more therapy, and you understand that kind of, you know, where is that coming from? What need is being met there? But I'm very much day-to-day work. I'm kind of, what can we do today? And if there's deeper stuff that needs to be done, I'd be recommending certain type of therapies to them. But it is a hard decision, and it's in any sector. If you're not happy in your job, I would say to people, don't make the decision when you're angry or when something big has just happened. I would say, take time off, get proper rest, journal, kind of get out, learn a little bit about yourself, do kind of some kind of personal development, and then come back with fresh eyes and say, okay, how am I going to make the best out of this situation? Do I change my boundaries in work? Do I change how I am in work? Do I kind of create a different model of working in work, or do I change the employment? So it's kind of giving choice.
That's good advice, that, for sure. Yeah, I think, I don't know, I'm no expert on this, but I think over the years, it still doesn't seem clear to what extent people's mental health is down to the circumstances that they're in. It's very hard to unpick that. That's my take on it. I just completely amateur read on that. You know, I think that because circumstances clearly play a role, but then there's all this other stuff, the way that you've been molded through your life and the trauma and experiences that you've had that play a role. And I think unpicking that it can be difficult. And I can imagine that that's a challenge when you're sat in front of someone, right?
Yes. Yes. So you have, like, going back to the nature versus nurture, you know, are we born traumatized? Are we predisposed to certain kind of mental health issues? You know, our family environment growing up, even if it's perfect and we had one trauma, how does that impact us, you know, on choices that we make? So it's hard to pinpoint, you know, and of where mental health issues stem from. But I think the difference with working with community sector and socioeconomic disadvantage to kind of more corporate world where people have way more resources is that the community sector is layered. There's so many issues that from, like, not getting the support to deal with, like, say, childhood trauma, and, you know, they could be full grown men at that stage, addiction, abuse. There's so many issues that are going on that it's only a tip of the iceberg when you're working with them. But I think if you're working with somebody else that has a lot more resources and can articulate things and comes from a family or a community where well-being was standardized, the mold was placed or developed quite well as a child. So they did sports, they got involved, they had a good school, they had good teachers, you know, they were fed well, they were very healthy, any health issues were sorted straight away. It's a different kettle of fish. Not to say that stress is stress and issues are issues and addiction is across the board. And there's many issues that can have an impact on our mental health and that could be across the board. But I think when we're coming to a position of support, that it can be a little bit quicker when you're working with somebody that has resiliency options, that has support options available quicker and better. And that has family supports, that has foundational, you know, kind of habits that are built in. They know that when they go to the gym 3 times a week, or they go hiking, or they go swimming, or they talk to their friends, they know that this is good for them. Some families never knew that, never got the opportunity to know that, because they were, you know, they were struggling. They had other priorities at that time, you know.
Yeah, and disadvantage, you know, in those disadvantaged communities, it's a kind of vicious cycle, isn't it? I can imagine that, you know, having one issue often leads to another, like typically addiction, you know, through self-medicating with substances and what have you, right? And that can all kind of spiral out of control, where, like you say, someone who's from a different background got all those advantages and is just, you know, is stressed in work. Yeah, that is different.
And it's not to minimise those that families in that, but I suppose working in the community sector for such a long time, at one stage I started, like, when I was about 15 or 16, doing research work with a pilot program, and I was out in the community and asking young people what they think about community resources and that, like. And I remember I worked with a young person then, and by the time I was leaving the community sector, that person was a grandparent, and, like, they were 38 and they were a grandparent. And they had addiction issues from the time they were a child. Their child had an addiction issue, and their grandchild now was in this chaotic family, you know, and only, unfortunately, you would see there's probably going to be more issues there in that family. So me being in that just for 20 years, you could see intergenerational trauma and addiction going on, and, you know, just that lack of, I suppose, real support that's given that can kind of stop that intergenerational issue continuing on.
It felt like you could probably make more of a difference, I don't know, in those previous roles to some extent. Definitely working within more challenging environments, more challenging cases perhaps, or am I simplifying it?
No. Make more of a difference. I think there's a collective that's needed when you're working with socioeconomic disadvantage. There's a number of different agencies that need.
Because different support services have to work together, kind of thing.
Yeah, definitely. It can't just be one. Whereas I feel with working with somebody that doesn't come from that background, that doesn't have that longer term trauma, that potentially you can have a really good impact with just, you know, that one bit of support. But there's definitely like a whole load of needs needed. And that's why I suppose it's very under-resourced out in the non-profit sector.
Of course. Yeah, no, I can imagine. Hello, a quick reminder from me that if you're enjoying our podcast series, why not become a member of the DMI so that you can enjoy loads more content from webinars and case studies to toolkits and more real-life insights from the world of digital marketing. Head to digitalmarketinginstitute.com/aheadofthegame to sign up for free. Now back to the podcast. Right, so you're working in a corporate environment, but are there certain types of role that seem to over-index a bit in terms of knocking on your door? Have you noticed any patterns there?
I could tell you a genre. So I would find more issues that are coming to me, the demographic would be a younger person that has moved across the world, that has landed themselves in a different country, their supports are gone, that they are really intelligent, they want to really succeed, they have excelled in education wise in previous jobs, they have gone to really prestigious colleges, but they burn fast and they burn out, that they are used to this standard of working, that they are the best of class. And then when they land themselves in a bigger pond where everyone else is best of class and everyone else is ridiculously intelligent, it's like, oh, hang on a minute, who am I? I need to double down here. I need to work twice as hard. I need to show up and make myself feel a little bit normal in the way I used to be. And they're working 12 hours a day. There's no kind of, there's no best practices of hybrid working. There's no best practices of working in this corporate environment. It's just like, I can give it my all 100% for months and don't say no, always show up. And then three or four months, they go, oh, this is too much. Others 10 months, other a year. And then they hit that wall and they're like, I can't do this. And I was like, no human can. You know, the expectations there are crazy that they put on themselves.
That's interesting. And to what extent are those expectations shaped by the culture into which they've arrived? Is it very competitive?
Yes. But you can choose to opt in and opt out. You can choose to say, okay, this is what I can give and I'm okay with this and I want to go long. So what I would say to people is you can go short, you can burn bright and you can burn out, or you can go easy and you can go longer and you can start to say no, it might be uncomfortable, you might not get the rewards as much as everybody else, but you will stay here longer, you know, by putting best practices in place, by putting your boundaries in place, by minding yourself. You'll get to see year three, year four, year five. You won't be gone in 2 years.
Wow, that's very interesting, isn't it? Yeah. When you say people are, they're kind of sprinting early in the marathon, is it because what kind of rewards are they after? Are we talking like job promotions or just like a pat on the back from management, you know, and just that recognition? I mean, what is it that people are chasing?
I would definitely be job promotion around performance. And they don't give themselves a minute to start. They don't give themselves like a minute to realise you've just changed country. You have to find a place to live in a place where it's very hard to find accommodation. Do you know, you have to find your ground in here. Give yourself a minute. You're only starting. And they come in and say, no, I need to be the best. There's a fear. There's an anxiety. There's a worry that they won't belong. They won't stay. And of course, you have your 6-month probation period. And there's an internalized kind of anxiety around, I need to be the best in class. I've always been the best. So there's a lot of pressure people put on themselves that they don't need to. But I understand why they have it. Like, they may have, like, culturally at home, they may have always been the best in their family, in their community. And it's like they can't be vulnerable. They can't take time off. They just So you're just internally, they just can't do it.
Yeah, no, I get that. I do. I've seen that myself, you know, working in media and advertising and what have you. And I've probably been guilty of that in my 20s. Because you're trying to make the most of that time. You know, it's, you know, they're the years that are going to shape the rest of your career. And so, you know, you kind of have to make hay while the sun shines and get ahead. And, you know, every major age milestone that's coming up, you're like, oh, I've got to do this before I'm 30. And then I've got to do this before I'm 35 and before I'm 40. And, you know, it's, I do understand that. And it's very good advice that you give by the sounds of it. I like that idea of just, you know, being the winning the race, the tortoise that wins the race, I suppose.
But don't get me wrong as well. Like, it's fun. Like, this is an amazing opportunity for a lot of people. And to get into a position that they're in, it's really, really good. Do you know? So there's a lot that it's mixed. It's layered. It's complex. Do you know? It's not kind of quite easy to say, oh, say no to this and say yes to this. So that's why, I suppose, how intelligent that they are, that they're still born out, because it's not clear cut.
Do you know what? I wouldn't. So there's a great piece of advice. It's from someone quite famous. I can't remember who, but it's basically your success in life is, the quote is, how well you do is in direct relation to how many difficult conversations you're willing to have. And I think that's very true. And I think that in people, particularly in their earlier career, they are kind of, and I was definitely, you say yes to a lot of stuff because you're talking about saying no, and that kind of uncomfortable feeling of saying, no, I'm sorry, I've got to go home at 5 o'clock because I've got a yoga class, or I need to just run a bath and, like, get, you know, chill out for a bit. And younger people don't feel like they've got license to say that. But I do think the more you can just embrace some of that discomfort of just pushing back a little bit, that in the long term, I think just, you know, it prepares you in lots of ways, for sure.
The disease to please, that's it. We have this need within us for people to like us and for acceptance. And with that is just saying, yes, no problem, absolutely. Do you know, and certain genders and certain cultures, it's unheard of that you say no. Do you know, you just show up for work, you just do what you're asked, you know, you don't say no.
Oh, interesting, right. So people arriving from different cultures maybe that are more strictly hierarchical, or where there's certain expectations of certain kinds of people.
Yes. And then it's what we're doing again is showing them that mirror, going, okay, you're making the decision to say yes here. So you're making yourself uncomfortable. You're the one that's putting the pressure on yourself by not having that uncomfortable conversation. And we would practice uncomfortable conversations because they are hard. I like don't like doing them. Nobody does. But it's like you can either keep going the way you're going and you lose, or you can have that uncomfortable conversation and there's a win-win. We can't be everything to everyone all the time. You need to put your own oxygen mask on first and then kind of cater for everyone else, you know?
That's true, very true. You know, the majority of our listeners are actually women, and I'd love to know what kind of things... are you finding yourself specifically giving women certain types of advice?
I'd say I am currently 50-50, weirdly enough.
But I mean, are there certain types of advice you find yourself giving to women?
Yes, I think there's similar advice now, but I think women, this is terrible, but women that have children are often the one that's organising the childcare, minding the child when they're sick. Unfortunately, now I definitely do think it's changing, and this is not for all women. So I think the advice, especially if they're hybrid, one of the biggest things that comes up is removing that guilt, removing that shame of not being 100% there for the kids and not being 100% there in work, taking day at a time. Because again, as I said earlier on, is having that layered worries and that layered stress. It's like deal with them as they come. And then women as well, it's a lot about articulating your needs, finding your voice in a way that can be heard, because it's still like there's domination here by the male perspective. Like, it's intertwined, you know. We're not nowhere near where we should be in equality, but it's seeing them little behaviours that we take on as women, that we do unbeknownst to ourselves sometimes, of like, why did I put my hand up there real quick to answer that? Why did I, you know, just take that job? Why did I assume that I'm the one that has to take the notes here in this meeting? You know, it's just kind of having a little bit of awareness of self and making choices then again, how you want to be. But there is, I think, culturally, and maybe as since we're small, I suppose, how we behave and how we have seen other women behave, that we need to start kind of changing up a little bit.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the hybrid style of working has definitely, because it's brought more of a mix between family life and work life, and both pull at you. You know, that's the same for all parents. You know, to some extent, the same for me. I feel that as a man. But I know that my wife feels that more keenly. There's something deep within her that really, it's a deeper thing within her, definitely, that irks at her about, and it is a guilt. You're right. A shame, actually, you put it. Yeah. They're not fully being there for the kids. So what advice would you give? And I am going to pass this on to my wife, whatever you say. what advice would you give to someone?
Well, the one is to drop the shame, drop the guilt. If you catch yourself in a moment on a day that the kids are not well, you have an appointment meeting to do, you know you're just going to be loaded with guilt and shame and worry and stress. It's to kind of be, you know, put that down for starters. And two, it's to have the conversation. If you have someone else at home that is a partner, talk about partnership, talk about equality, talk about the jobs at home are not male versus female. They're not kind of like, you know, certain worries or concerns. They should be shared out. They should be having it. You know, you're nodding there. You're like, oh, yeah, you've had this conversation, have you?
I think a lot of men I know, just they need to be just given that task. You know, not asked about it. They just need to be told, you're doing the pickup, you know, I think.
But see, I would have a little bit of a problem there, because then it's still the female being the captain. It's still like just say me and my husband, right? Now, it's not perfect, but I would still kind of go, right, these are the jobs, you have to do this. And he's happy with me telling him what to do. And it's like, why do I get the job to divvy out the jobs? Why do I get the job to remember everything, to, you know, coordinate everything? Can you handle that coordination? And then you tell me, you know, take turns maybe of coordinating of it. Like, so it's. But it's that in itself. I think there's areas for growth massively in both genders, in all genders, right? Whereas women, you know, kind of articulating needs and not being afraid to say, look, this is what I need from you. This is what, you know, where I need you to rise up to be an equal partner. And for men to be aware of the fact of that, women tend to take all the responsibility of the childcare needs, the house needs, and the work needs. So it's just kind of saying, okay, I'll take this, you take that, and let's have a real partnership, do you know? But again, it's an uncomfortable conversation, especially you talked about the moulds, like women, we have had moulds of women that just took care of all the kids and took care of all the house needs and, you know, did all that job. And then men have moulds of the dads just going out to work and coming back. It's like,
especially in more traditional cultures, again, that's cultural, definitely.
100%. And so it's hard to break the mold, and it's difficult and it's challenging, and people get attached to who they are, and they feel like they're, you know, the wife is coming at them and they're nagging all day, and it's like, this is not cool, this is not fun. It's like, nobody wants that. But I think it's together both saying, okay, how do we mind each other in this? How do we both show up for each other, and how do we both have uncomfortable conversations where we both can hear what's going on? Because I suppose in my work, I've worked with men and women. And I suppose the lovely piece of work that I was doing with the men at risk of suicide is I got the opportunity to see the real issues of men, whereas I've only had my experience as a woman and, kind of, you know, kind of listen to other women and the issues and being a mother, knowing the ins and outs of that. But I never really got the insight of how men hold shame themselves, of especially if they're not working, of, you know, not being good enough and not knowing the standards, and when they don't show up, it's like they hold that in. And
well, that's another traditional expectation, isn't it? You know, if a man doesn't have a job that pays well and puts bread on the table for everyone, that's a source of shame in itself, isn't it, for men, that's keenly felt by them.
And the statistics there that show that, like, when men are unemployed, that there's an increase there in suicidal ideation, because it's nearly like they attribute who they are, their role in the family, in the community, to be the worker, to be the provider. And when you take that away, it's like, who are they? What good are they? And then you kind of bring in all the other issues that are going to happen. So it's a layered conversation. I think it can start with just being a bit kinder to ourselves and articulating our needs.
Is this something that a partner can do if their partner is suffering from stress at work? You know, I'm thinking about the home being quite a good place to soak up some of the pressure or in some way help. Do you know what I mean? So if there's people listening who have partners that have really stressful jobs, what could they be doing?
Yeah, I suppose to provide space to be present and to listen. Do you know, there's one being available for them and recognize that it's not like, just say my husband has a really stressful job and he comes home every evening and he's having a pint or whatever and he's just stressed and he's not the best person. Instead of me assuming that this is about me, just to kind of have that conversation, I notice you're doing X, Y, Z. How do you feel about that? Do you know, to be there to listen, not to nag, not to give out, not to kind of say, this is what I need from you, or think about your own needs. We'll think about your own needs in a minute. But if you know that you have somebody that has a very stressful job, get them to an environment where you can have a clear communicate, a clear talk, good dialogue. And that could be in a space where it's not too invasive. I noticed before when I'm working with lads, I tend to kind of, if we could do something together, the conversation is a little bit easier. So if you're both kind of working on something or you're going for a walk or there's something that you're not kind of like directly face to face. So if you get to a space where you can be open and hear them and reflect back, look, you are like, I see your behavior is not, it's not what you want to be. Is this what you want out of life? Is this where we want to go? What can I do to help you get there? But also, I would, another recommendation I'd make is that the other partner that's not stressed is to have good fundamental practices on well-being. So like you're going to your gym, you're doing your mindfulness. If you're going to a therapist, be open about it. Do you know, talk about how you relieve stress, what works for you when you're stressed. Do you know, and you can have that extra connection of like, yeah, we all get stressed. This is what I do. What do you do? You know?
Yeah, it's a good point, isn't it? You don't need to be just adding more stress to their lives by nagging them and saying, why are you so stressed? And why have you fallen into maybe slightly unhealthy behaviours? So, you know, why have you eaten all the chocolate or drinking all the beer or something?
See, yeah, you had me at chocolate. If he eats all the chocolate, there's no going back. But it's again going back to that, putting that wedge between the stimulus, him not showing up for you or her not showing up for you and the partner you want and your response. So you want to kind of just make sure, take a breath and just go, how do I want to get the best out of this situation? How do I want to help my partner in this moment? What does he need from me right now?
Which takes a level head.
That's what, get your own fundamentals in place first, you know, doing your exercise, getting rid of all that cortisol, you know, and getting good sleep, but having the basic stuff in place so you are in a space to hear this and you won't be as reactive.
Yeah. So jumping back into the workplace, if you were the CEO of a massive tech company, you know, one of, let's say it's just one of the tech companies headquartered in Dublin there, what would you change about the workplace and its culture?
I would not like that job. When it's for profit, you have to have it. You're for profit. You're in it for money. Do you know, you're there to make money.
Of course, but you're also there to... Well, maybe, I don't know how directly, it depends, it varies, doesn't it? But in some way, the culture comes from the top. And I suppose what you know, if you look at the big tech companies, you know, the free dinners and the I don't know, brown bag lunches and the training budgets. I don't know, the things that they offer staff, right? Away days and all this kind of stuff. But are there specific things that you would do more or less of if you were completely in control of one of these big companies?
I think you actually mentioned there what I was thinking around culture. The biggest impact in here, or where in different types of kind of global companies, I think is culture. So you can have a top-down approach to change culture. So for an individual at the top to really promote mental health, well-being, and actively kind of put boundaries in place and kind of, you know, walk the walk of what we want other people to do, I would think that will trickle down, because you can have all the shiny things in the world, but the culture will make you not engage with that shiny stuff, because I want to be a part of this team. I want to belong. I want to be the best of. But if you had somebody at the top shown the benefits of how you can succeed and be successful by minding yourself, by putting the dimensions of well-being in place, that would have a big impact.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You are right. It can't just be some, you know, it can't just come from people like you. It needs to then be adopted from the top down, because everything trickles down from them. That's absolutely right. So a lot of people you work with, I would imagine, are part of teams that span the globe. So what advice do you give to people who are working with people in those kind of time zones?
Yeah, it happens a lot. It's difficult. And one learning in here is that, I suppose, the time zones, you could be working every hour of the day constantly, no problem. And there's always somebody looking for something. But one is to set your boundaries. Book an hour in your week to set your plan of what times you are working and what times you aren't working. And make sure the times you aren't working, you include things like social, things like family, things like house maintenance, you know, all that kind of stuff. And stick to the boundaries as best you can.
How do you actually, where are those boundaries? You mean like actually booking it in your calendar that you're...
Yes. And even do it with your wife as well. Like that, do it. It's like sit down and kind of say, right, this is my work shift. This is what I'm doing all the week. It's that good communication as well. It's coming in handy. And saying, right, what do we need for this week? Where's my self-care? How am I minding myself? Where's my exercise? What's the story with nutrition this week? Who's doing the shopping for the food? Who's doing the dinners? What are we eating? Because a lot of the times, you know, you kind of pick up the takeaways and, you know, you kind of slack. And another impact as well is when we're working late, when we're working with the West Coast, what tends to happen is the later you work, you're more activated and your sleep is impacted. And that's huge. So you want to kind of have a transition period from work to sleep where you have that downtime, you have that relaxation. So you get that better sleep. And then another thing that actually comes up a lot is that because we're working late, we're not focused. We're not kind of fully present when we're there. So you can do things like binaural beats. Do you ever hear them? You kind of listen to that. So like say 5 minutes to 30 minutes before your meeting, or brown, white, pink noise, have a listen to them, cold water exposure, the caffeine. It's kind of just to make you back into that a new circadian rhythm maybe of being focused, because we have our daily rhythm. And then if it's going to be upset by the work schedule, like our new work-life integration, we need to be mindful of, okay, when am I focused and when do I need to relax? So it's just, again, another awareness and putting things in place for you to prepare to be the best version of yourself at that time.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, isn't it? So there's a couple of things to say there, that we all have different rhythms. Like, you know, I'm very active in the morning and in the evening. In the afternoon, a bit slumpy for me. So that's why we're doing this in the afternoon, because I often do my meetings, try and put my meetings in the afternoon and then deep work morning and evenings. Not everyone's like that. How sympathetic. So if I went and got a job at a big corporate and I said, yeah, guys, I really want this job, but just so you know, I'll be around in the morning, the evening, afternoon, you won't be able to get hold of me. Or if it's for really mindless stuff like a meeting, that's fine. You know, how would they react to that?
It does happen. I'll be honest. It really, really, really does happen. Where people block their calendars and say, I'm available for this meeting, that meeting. Now, obviously, there's sometimes you have to say, well, actually, no, I need you at this particular time.
Of course, yeah.
But if you can set your boundaries and you can say, right, well, I'm available because of the way we're working, because it's global, because you have to be sometimes on from 9 a.m, 8, 7 a.m.
So there's nothing wrong with working in the evening, really. What you're saying is just be clear about it up front, predict it, put it in the diary, be okay with it, make sure everyone's bought in, like your partner at home and your employer. And the time that you've said you're not working, that you ring fence that, you switch your notifications off and you don't let work invade.
That's it, but be okay with it, because we have been conditioned to be available 9 to 5. We've been conditioned to be available to work, do you know? So there's always that little part of, even though you're not on, you're kind of thinking about being on, or you're feeling guilty, or there's FOMO, there's something going on. So it's catching yourself again, going, actually, I need to detach here to get the best downtime so I can be 100% then when I am in work. And it's the same when we go on holidays. It's the same, you know, when you're wrecked and you need that PTO, you need that kind of big chunk of self-care. It's like, there's no point in going on holidays if you're going to be constantly thinking and worrying about work. We need a place to put work when it comes up and hold it maybe in your notes, in your phone, and then kind of come back to that relaxation, that rest. Because we do all have our certain rhythms. We have certain times of day. Like, my focus time is the morning. I will get more work done from 7 in the morning till 12 in the day, and then the rest of the day, like, I'm all right at the moment, but normally 3 o'clock I'll be like, ugh.
Yeah, no, that's true. I think it's just finding that out and being okay with it. And yeah, like you say, shaping your schedule around it. I've got one more question to ask you. There's in the corporate world, particularly in the tech world, there's been a lot of news of layoffs and change. We do seem to be entering some sort of transitional period generally, I think, in sort of corporate life. In lots of ways. So how's this kind of manifest? How are you seeing this manifest? Are people becoming anxious about their job more with talk of recession and lots of talk of layoffs? And what do you say to them?
I do see this, and the manifestation is anxiety, is worry and concern, and the negative implications, not just for themselves, but where they live. Some people have moved country. Their residency is aligned with their job. Some people are sending money back. You know, they're supporting other people at home. So it can have a drastically negative implication if the job loss was to happen to individuals. So it's a warranted anxiety. It's a warranted worry. Like, so when I would speak to somebody, first of all, I would validate and say, look, you're completely right in your worries. It is concerning to think about. But we would move on to your circle of control. We would move on to, okay, right, this is a maybe over here that potentially may impact you. Let's talk about what you can control in this situation and what you can't control in this situation. And then if it is, we try and kind of like get into practicalities of, okay, so do you want to update your LinkedIn? Do you want to kind of start a new education, start a new course in UCD in digital marketing? I hear it's brilliant. What do you want to do? Like, is there practical steps that you can take that if in the case that this does happen, at least you have your ducks in a row, or you can bounce, you can kind of move jobs, you can kind of like look what else there. And then making a decision to park it. This is not in my control. The layoffs that are happening, it doesn't seem to be easily understood who's going, who's staying. It's not as simple as last in, first out in some scenario. So it's making that conscious decision to say, I can't control this. This is what I'm going to do. I can't control that. And at the same time, validate feelings and maybe be aware of the emotional distress. And is there something else that needs to be put into place? Because it's, you know, it could be triggering for them. Something else could happen previously in their life that they need support from as well. So there's a few things that you can do.
If you can't change it, don't worry about it. If you can change it,
do it.
Change it.
Yeah. Yeah. Easier said than done. But
It is, it's age old and wise advice that. Fantastic. Well, look, I feel like I've taken so much of your time. I do have one last question for you. Sorry, it's just, where can people find you and connect with you online?
I'm on LinkedIn. You could find me on LinkedIn. I'm actually Catherine Mooney Connolly. I must get that in for the husband.
Well, Catherine, thanks so much. I feel like I've learned so much in that hour. Very, very interesting. I could talk to you all day about this stuff, obviously, because it's so fascinating. But yeah, thanks very much. Really appreciate it.
Well, thanks, Emil, for having me on. It's been really interesting. Yeah.
If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about transforming your marketing career through certified online training, head to digitalmarketinginstitute.com. Thanks for listening.